Thank you for listening to Every Square Inch, the podcast ministry of Christ for Kentucky. Our generous financial partners ensure that our entire ministry, including this podcast, is offered as a free resource to everyone. However, if our content has been a blessing to you, would you consider blessing our Kentucky neighbors? Rather than a donation to Christ for Kentucky, the best way to thank us for the podcast is your tax-deductible contribution to our campaign to relieve the medical debt burden upon Kentucky's most vulnerable. A link to those details can be found in the description of this podcast. Thanks for considering, and we hope you enjoy this episode of Every Square Inch. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Thank you very, very much for the warm and encouraging feedback from last week's episode, which served as the launch for our campaign to abolish the medical debt of Kentucky's most vulnerable. I will keep everyone updated as that progresses. We will be updating the campaign's website, webpage, christforky.org/debt relief, with information and updates along the way. Might record another podcast. More to come. But in the meantime, just keep spreading the word and, of course, participating with your own donation if you haven't yet. Now, I am excited to get into my new series, which, broadly speaking, is going to be on the subject of masculinity. Not just the crisis of masculinity, but the importance of masculinity, the potential masculinity. For a variety of reasons that we will discuss, I think this cultural moment is desperate for guidance on the topic of masculinity, and I think Christians are ill-equipped to have that discussion, maybe even fearful to have that discussion, because any discussion surrounding masculinity is fraught with many hazards. So I spent a lot of time researching and preparing for what I hope will be a helpful resource on masculinity from a Christian biblical perspective. And to introduce that discussion, I've recorded a conversation that I hope you will enjoy and be encouraged by. As you know, I don't do many interviews or conversations on the podcast, although I do have some exciting ones planned for the end of the year. But typically, this is just kind of my own personal outlet for Christian cultural engagement and critique and so forth. But I wanted to have a conversation about something transpiring that I think you will find fascinating and encouraging. And it's going to set the stage for my upcoming series on masculinity. Obviously, my love and devotion belong first to Kentucky. But if I had a secondary place that has kind of captured my heart, it's the United Kingdom for several reasons. Ministry opportunities, some friendships, my PhD studies. Over the past 15 years, I guess, the UK has become a little bit of a home away from home for me, specifically England and Scotland. And something fascinating is transpiring over there. There is an unexpected return to Christianity. Obviously, Christianity was the foundation not just of the UK, but the entire Western society. But the assumption, particularly for Western Europe, was that Christianity, the Christianity of its origins, has officially been rejected. They're not just a post-Christian society, but an antagonist society toward the religion of its origins. Fully secular, irreversible, Christianity is dead, or at least on life support. But God is doing something surprising. I personally have noticed it anecdotally, but recently a study was conducted, and now we have data backing up what I and many others have been sensing, really since COVID, and it's that a revival is afoot in the UK. They are calling it the Quiet Revival, and the demographic of the revival is both fascinating and I would say hopeful. It's the youth. British youth are returning to the faith that their parents and grandparents rejected. And it's really staggering numbers. You can Google the Quiet Revival to see the data for yourself, but here are a few highlights. In 2018, only 4% of 18 to 24-year-olds attended church regularly in the UK. And that represents, by the way, the trend of Christianity in the West overall, right? And some fear the future of Christianity in America. 4% dying religion. But what the recent findings demonstrate is that now 16% of 18 to 24-year-olds are attending church. I don't think you realize how significant that jump in church attendance is. That 4% to 16%, that is a common multi-generational Christian growth taking over a country or culture, again, over a couple generations. That took place in the span of 5 years, 4 to 16% of British youth. That's staggering, frankly, revival numbers. But here's what's even more astounding. Within those numbers, within that youth demographic, it's the young men, more than even the young women, who are returning to Christianity. 4% to 21% of men 18 to 24. That's unfathomable from our perspective, again, outside of revival. If you would have visited the UK 5, 6, 7 years ago, it would have been difficult to find a young man who goes to church. Now, if you were to go there, slightly more than 1 in 5 British young men are attending church regularly. It's not just a revival, it's a masculine revival. And guess what? We don't have as comprehensive data as was just released in the UK, but similar trends are starting to show in America. This month, the Pew Research Center released findings that seem to suggest that the decline of Christianity in America has stalled and is even beginning to reverse course. The reason for it? Again, not just our youth, not just Gen Z, which is true, but young men in particular. Axios published a helpful article summarizing the data, if you want to look at that. It's entitled, Why Young Men Are Leading a Religious Resurgence. So anyway, I find all of this fascinating, exciting, encouraging, and it's also a perfect way to introduce my discussion on masculinity and what's taking place. So what I did is I asked two friends from the UK if they would come on for a discussion. One is a pastor, one is a public thought leader. Andy Longwy is the pastor of London City Presbyterian Church. I highly, highly, highly recommend his church. If you are listening to this and you live in the London area, certainly recommend it. But Americans, if you are ever over in London vacation, cannot recommend London City Pres highly enough. And then Glenn Scrivener runs an incredible ministry called Speak Life. It is a media and apologetics ministry that, again, I highly, highly recommend. Podcast, YouTube, all that content. Links to both of their ministries are going to be in the description. And I brought these two on to discuss this quiet revival. But most of our time, you're going to see, particularly the second half, is spent discussing the masculine dynamic of the revival. A fascinating conversation, encouraging conversation, and a perfect way to introduce our new series on Christian masculinity. I hope you enjoy. Okay, joined with two brothers, friends from the UK, Andy Longwy and Glenn Scrivener, to discuss what's being called the quiet revival taking place in their culture. Andy and Glenn, I think, why don't you both, instead of me introduce you, why don't you just both briefly introduce yourself however you want to be introduced. Andy, well, start with you.
I'm Andy Longwy, a minister of London City Presbyterian Church. We're a church that meets in the heart of London on Aldersgate Street, just down from St. Paul's. I'm married to Marina, and we've got two little ones, Theo and Ellie.
You forgot to tell them who married you in a kilt.
And that's right. That's a big part of the story. You married us in a kilt in Scotland, yeah. Robert.
Yes, I did. Yes, I
dagger and all. All right, Glenn, tell us about yourself.
So I am Glenn. I am Emma's husband. I'm Ruby and JJ's dad. I am from Australia, but I live on the south coast of England because my wife is from Northern Ireland. I'm from Australia. And so my wife thinks that living on the south coast of England is halfway. And I let her think that, and that's the secret to a good marriage. So we've got Ruby is 10 years old, JJ is 7 years old, and I'm an evangelist. I'm ordained in the Church of England, but my day job is to work for Speak Life, a ministry that frees me up to speak around the place and online as well.
So you're ordained. I don't think I ever looked into this or asked you. So you're ordained in the Anglican Church, but do you have in our world, in the Presbyterian Church in America, we have a category called outside the bounds, which is what I do. I'm an out of bounds minister, which is
I bet you love that.
Very flattering way to describe my work. You're out of bounds, but so do you all have a category for ordination where you're able to not be tied to a conventional local church and you're able to kind of be kind of a cultural voice, an evangelist?
Yeah. Right. So I have permission to officiate in the diocese, but my day job is to work for this charity, this ministry called Speak Life.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay. Well, and personally, just for everybody to know, the reason why I don't often have folks on the podcast, but I trust both of these men. I know Andy very, very, very well. But I have grown to really appreciate Glenn and his work from afar. I've been on his podcast at one point as well. But just trust them for different reasons. Glenn is kind of a bigger picture, cultural apologist and commentary voice. And then Andy is just kind of a on the ground and down in the weeds of pastoring amid whatever the Lord is doing over there. So I thought they kind of brought two unique perspectives to the conversation that I'm excited to hear. So, all right, guys, let's just jump right in as broadly as possible. So the data is one thing, but I think it would help to hear maybe anecdotally from just two Christian leaders in the middle of this supposed quiet revival. Here's what I want to say. So you got the research, but really what I want to hear is from your experience, is this real? Are you seeing it? How are you seeing it and experiencing it? Even before the study was released, which I happened to be over in the UK at the time when it was released, even before the study was released, were you noticing kind of this cultural return? I think a peer of yours, Justin Briley, doesn't he call it the rebirth of belief going on? Are you feeling it and seeing it apart from the research? Maybe, Glenn, we'll start with your experience.
Well, Justin Briley wrote the book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. He's got a great podcast by the same name. But in his book and in the podcast, even though he was noticing different conversations going on in the culture, that really hadn't been reflected in the data. And the only statistics that he cites in the book are the ones that go against the idea that there's a surprising rebirth. He says, look, I understand the secularization thesis. I understand de-Christianization. I understand that in the States, for instance, there is a great de-churching, the name of a book by Michael Graham and others, where 40 million Americans have left church this century in the States. And maybe we had come to the idea that secularization is inevitable. It's just a ratchet that always goes in one direction. But then I think this report is the first report that goes in the other direction and goes very starkly in the other direction. So a difference of 8% church going in 2018 to 12% in 2024, a difference among 18 to 24-year-olds of less than 4% to 16% church going. And when you talk about men in that age bracket, you're going up to 21%. Are you serious?
Yeah.
And one thing you've got to think is that that's self-report. But the other thing you've got to think is it's people self-reporting about their church-going attendance, and the same question was asked in 2018 as was asked in 2024. So whatever is happening and whatever that statistic means, something has gone up by five, right? So
yeah.
Something has quintupled. And I think there's more of a social permission to be able to say, I'm going to church, why don't you come with me? And I literally was just walking along the seafront on the south coast of England about 20 minutes ago and bumped into a guy called Josh. And Josh has come to our church in the last 6 months. He's a doctor in the NHS, kind of a emergency room doctor. And he was one of the new atheists when he was at university, when he was training as a medic. He was very much on the side of Dawkins. He was very much on the side of Christopher Hitchens. He was in all sorts of humanist debating societies and all that sort of stuff. And he has jumped. He, in particular, happened to have jumped onto the Jordan Peterson train and recognized that there's wisdom in the Bible for life. And he just showed up in church. And I remember the first time he showed up in church about 6 months ago. He was sat on the other side of me from Timothy. And Timothy had just started coming to church. Again, a guy in his 20s. He hadn't heard of Jordan Peterson, but he certainly followed some social media influencers that are sort of in that orbit. And you start looking around church, and there are about half a dozen such young guys in the last 6 months that have just shown up from nowhere, and they say, I've ordered a Bible from Amazon. And you say, why do you do such a thing? And they said, well, the Bible's built in the modern world and I don't know the first thing about it. And I asked this one guy who's joined us recently, you know, what translation did you order? And he said, oh, the old one. I was like, King James? He said, yeah, I guess. I said, where did you start reading? He was like, Genesis?
At the beginning?
At the beginning, duh. It's a book. And so he shows up in church with lots of questions about Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus. And he's got lots of questions about the sacraments. And he's got lots of questions about... And he's got thorny pastoral issues that he needs to walk through in his life. And he's got huge eagerness and almost zero knowledge. And it's a glorious mess, but I love it.
Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah, I want to return to, Andy, I want to get your thoughts pastorally at your church, but I do want to return to something you always start talking about, the whole Jordan Peterson and kind of the futility of the new atheist, the dogmatic new atheist approach, and starting to rethink, well, what did build the society that we love so much, and specifically your book and all that. I do want to kind of get into, is there a little bit of a utilitarian relationship with Christianity going on right now? But push pause there, because Andy, what, you know, this study came out, but were you experiencing it? Are you seeing it in your church and churches of your peers? What's going on as a pastor on the ground?
So I moved to London to take up this call 3 years ago. And just as I landed in London, the census results came out that said that the tipping point had been reached in England and Wales. There were now more people who did not self-identify as Christian than Christian, which was a huge seismic change in our culture. So I started ministry with this expectation. I'm ministering in a post-Christian secular context, and I want to wrestle with that whole reality. But the surprising thing was, week after week, month after month, there was young men, women walking through the doors, no faith background, curious questions. And I'm telling you that the stories that Glenn has just given, I could give identical stories to that. Young guys going online, buying a Bible on Amazon, starting to read it, then showing up in church. Young guys, young women going online, discovering Jordan Peterson and many others, listening to Tom Holland's podcast, whatever it was, just little things that have been used and showing up in church. In the last 3 years, like, it's just been this crazy thing where I look at what God has done. We have welcomed in dozens of new members.
Yeah.
But the surprising and remarkable thing is, say, in my last 6 years of ministry in Scotland, I think maybe a couple of baptisms of people coming professing faith. In the last 3 months, we've baptized six individuals who've all come to faith. Mm. And this is becoming normal. And this story among in the pastors in my network and pastors here in London, this is normal. People are coming to faith. People are showing up in church. People are reading their Bible. The amount of people that I meet with who are just coming to church and then saying, I just want someone to help me understand the Bible. Mm. I've started reading it. Can you help me? Anecdotally, in my experiences, God is doing something. It's quiet. It's quintessentially British. A lot of these people are coming to the Lord at home.
Yeah.
Online or ordering the Bible. It starts there. It's not like a mass movement, a big event.
Yeah, it's a very quiet revival. So it's very, very British. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't want to get vulgar about it.
Well, I do want to come to that in a second, but I just personally, Andy, the last time I preached at your church, that was a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I mean, the attendance was obvious. It's full.
Full.
Now, it might have been, was it spring break and a bunch of Americans? Every American comes to your church.
That's every week now.
Okay, okay. So attendance full, and there was an adult baptism, which I have preached over there many times. I'm not talking about your church, but in Scotland, I've preached over there many times. I think it's the first adult baptism I've witnessed. but the vibrancy of worship. Mm. Now, mine have been in response to the stirring preaching, you're a Presbyterian Free Church, you know, I mean, like it, but the vibrancy of singing and I don't know, it just felt different. And then a day later, that study came out and I was just like, wow, the Lord's doing something. So guys, what is going on in your estimation? Like what, I know the Spirit blows where he wills and revival belongs to the Lord, but is there something unique about the current cultural moment in the West that is creating this fertile ground for this Spirit movement? You all brought, you know, you got Tom Holland, you brought up Jordan Peterson, Glenn, you wrote a book that was a real service to people like me who took Holland's research and made it understandable for not as smart people, The Air We Breathe, which is an incredible book. But is your sense that the society that we took for granted is now being challenged, and therefore people are saying, wait a minute, before we give up on all this, we probably need to research, which would, I guess my concern would be, is it a revival of cultural Christianity, or is it a revival of Christ and Christianity itself? I guess I asked a lot there, but my original question was, what do you guys think is going on?
Well, I think the phenomenon goes well beyond Tom Holland, the historian. So I've got a neighbor who's four doors up from me, and he just took himself and his whole family off to church saying, well, I guess Christianity has shaped, you know, the West, or I forget how he put it, but, you know, Christianity has shaped us, and I need to find out more. So I'm taking my family off to church. And two things were funny about that. I then said to him, oh, right, is it the whole Tom Holland thing? And he said, what does Spider-Man have to do with that? You know? And what I love about that is that, yeah, the Tom Holland thesis, the historian Tom Holland thesis, is much broader than Tom Holland. You don't need to listen to the Rest Is History podcast. You don't need to have Dominion on your shelf to be feeling this. And in fact, it's the other way around. The only reason why his book has become such a bestseller is because the culture is ripe for it. We're ready. My neighbor is ready for that. Well, my neighbor is ready for Dominion for Dummies, which is the book that I've written. And I'm the dummy, right?
But Dominion for Dummies, that's a great way to put it, yeah.
with me being the dummy, but yeah. But what's interesting, when my neighbor said, I'm taking my family off to church, the house opposite, that guy was in on the conversation, and he said, yeah, I should probably go too. And it was just his use of the word should that really gripped me, because I was just like, oh, there's now this new, not even just social permission, but now perhaps even social expectation, or that it's one of those things you really ought to do, like going to the gym or something. It's one of those things I really ought to drink more water and show up at Sunday worship.
Yeah.
and that's kind of happened because I think for some quite Dominion style reasons that, We're starting to discover that we are an ineradicably religious animal, right? And the secular story that we can just jettison Christian faith and get on as secular people is far less plausible than it ever has been. It was never that plausible if you were paying attention to what people are like. And if you pay attention to history, you know, there is no such civilization that is founded on properly secular values, right? There simply is you know, no such thing. And we're sort of finding that out as the story of the West runs out of road, and people are just trying. And, I mean, it is a glorious mess because people are trying witch talk as well.
Right.
And they're trying Quran reading challenges as well. And, you know, there's the New Age, and there's trying ayahuasca, and there's all sorts of stuff that people are trying. But Christianity is definitely back on the table as one of those things that you should do. So that's good. On the question of cultural Christianity, one of the interesting findings from the report, The Quiet Revival, is that even fewer people are now identifying as Christians. So it was massive news when the 2021 census came out and it said less than half of the British population identify as Christian. I think it's an even lower percent. It might be like 43% or something in the Quiet Revival. So there is a shrinkage of nominalism, actually, even as there are more people showing up in church. For that, I give great thanks, right?
Yeah.
And the other really interesting finding about cultural Christianity in the report is they asked people all sorts of well-being questions, and they put it at the beginning of the survey, and they asked people, do you have a sense of meaning in life, a sense of purpose, a sense of hope for the future? Are you happy? On the flip side, do you feel anxiety? And actual churchgoers outscore non-churchgoers in a really remarkable way. And that's really great. But for those who say that they are Christian but who don't go to church, they perform worse than non-churchgoers, right? If you don't go to church...
Say it again, say that.
Yeah. So if you claim to be a Christian but you don't show up in church, you perform worst on these measurements of well-being. You are the least happy, you are the most anxious, you have less sense of hope for the future. If you are a cultural Christian but you don't show up in church. So one of the things that the data is showing is actually there is a shrinking population of nominal Christianity, and nominal Christianity is definitively not good for you.
Right.
According to this survey, which I find fascinating. Now, does that mean that the people who show up in church are already cooked? Are they already believers in the Lord Jesus and they can sign up to the Nicene Creed? Absolutely not. But I think it's a kind of a healthy thing. And maybe this is my Anglican ecclesiology coming in a little bit. But we play chaplain to the nation in the Church of England. And people belong to us before they believe, right? And I think you get that among pedo-Baptists as well, more generally. But the Anglicans are that to an extreme. Certainly the Church of England is. You belong first and then you believe. But I think there is an opportunity there, because I think that is how beliefs do shift. There's a new plausibility structure, and you don't so much think your way into a new way of living. That what people are doing is live their way into a new way of thinking, and they want the beliefs. So it's not like they just want community and they just want a tribal identification. They do want the beliefs, but they're kind of diving in with both feet to something deep and rich and old and strange and challenging, and they want something sacramental and liturgical, actually, and they want something with the deep weird of the Bible. And so I don't think that is instrumentalizing Christianity. I think it's that they're just doing their best to get their head around Christianity. And actually, before they get their head around it, they're actually diving in with both feet and trying to live it.
That's cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I'm in the throes of my next series is on masculinity, which is very fitting with this study on Christ's masculinity. And Nancy Piercy talks about this a lot, but the best husbands are church-going husbands.
Yes.
Second best husbands are secular husbands. The worst husbands are people who claim to be Christians but do not attend church. Yes. They're the most angry, abusive, fornicating. I mean, the worst husband you can have is someone who claims to be a Christian but is not serious about their Christianity.
The sociologist Brad Wilcox, he says, my research suggests that the most violent husbands in America are nominal evangelical Protestants who attend church infrequently or not at all. So that absolutely gels with this.
But the best husbands by far are the theologically conservative, you know, everything you think of. Okay, let's jump in. Okay. I want to respect your time. So in light of that, let's talk about the thing that I think is probably getting talked about the most, which is young male demographic in this study and what this is telling. The number of Gen Z youth returning to Christianity is staggering, but within the data of the generation, Gen Z young men is what people, like, I think it was 4% to 21% or something like that. I think it's telling... I also think it's telling that just as the data was released, something else in the UK was kind of gripping American culture, and that was Adolescence on Netflix. And that series started, you know, this, if you have, I'm sure you'll have, but it's getting talked a lot about over here. It's just hauntingly, maybe a bit sensational about, are your schools that bad?
Yeah, right. They're not.
It was pretty pure bad. Pandemonium in your schools on that show. But the point being, I just think the crisis of masculinity, but then this study maybe showing the potential of masculinity and all that, the masculine angle to this study and to this revival. Andy, what are you seeing among the men that you're ministering to there in London? And maybe even not the necessarily the men that you're ministering in your church, but just the men in London, the young men in London, you know, these young professionals moving through this powerful global city, you know, with all these dreams and aspirations. What are you seeing taking place both inside and outside your church?
So, you know, as we all know, the last 5-10 years, there has been this crisis of masculinity that has led men to be scared in case they get cancelled, they're toxic. And so I think there's been a reaction. We were lots of men going on to the gaming and being passive and ignoring it. Now what I witness is men are searching for meaning and purpose, and they're really, really hungry for transcendence. They're really, really hungry for something that's robust and rich. And so lots of the men, and as Glenn touched on, they're not just looking to Christianity. There's lots of people are experimenting with so many different things.
Right.
But there has been a huge rise, and I think the report gives voice to it. There's been an upsurge in the Catholic Church, an upsurge in Eastern Orthodoxy and Pentecostalism. And what I'm seeing is a lot of men are turning towards Christianity, and they want the transcendence. They want meaning. They want a vision of masculinity. They want the weird and the wonderful things that they've perhaps the gateway drug has been Jordan Peterson, giving them a sort of vision, a moral vision of what Christianity can offer. They've maybe stumbled across someone like Doug Wilson or someone else, and they've come to church to say, give me more of this sort of vision. So I see a huge opportunity for us in the church to disciple men because of the crisis that has been with masculinity. But it's an opportunity that needs real wisdom, because we're not going to give a copycat vision of a toxic masculinity or a muscular masculinity that comes from the world and the culture, but we need to give them one that is rooted and grounded in Christ. And I do think that some guys, they see Christianity as a strategy for just how they can improve self, whereas we want to give them a vision of how they can surrender to the Lord and serve the Lord and be a servant, a better husband, a better employee, so on and so forth. So that's been my experience in our church. That one of the striking things, I don't know if you noticed it when you were there, Robert, is just the sheer numbers of young men who are in our church. It's it's been fascinating that I can only talk to what I'm seeing, but I'm hearing that there's a lot of young men who are turning to Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy because there's the cracks of secularism, the vision, it's not working, and they're just longing for something much more. And so they're turning in large numbers to the church.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a real thing. I mean, and now we got an American Pope, so American men flocking to Catholicism. Yeah, it's a real thing over here as well. Glenn, what are your thoughts on the whole masculine component to this?
Yeah, and just to add in on the Roman Catholic thing and the Pentecostal thing. So if you're a young churchgoer, if you're under 34 years of age and you go to church, you're twice as likely to be going to a Roman Catholic church as you are to a Church of England church. And you're just as likely to be going to a Pentecostal church as you are going to the state church, the Church of England. So Pentecostalism and Roman Catholicism, one of the common denominators is they both have a sense of the transcendence in very different ways. They're both weird, right? In the best sense, but they're both not what you would ordinarily get if you go to somewhere else on a Sunday morning. But also immigration is another issue that needs to be factored in. And the UK has had a lot of immigration recently, and some of that is behind some of these statistics. But I think the report gives good news both about immigration and about young men. And it's interesting, in the culture wars, usually one side quite likes to hear good news about young men and the other side likes to hear good news about immigrants. And I guess the church has got good news for both, actually. On the young men kind of thing, I absolutely see that there are female-coded ways of operating in the world and female-coded ways of operating in the church that have been dominant for quite a while. It's very different, you know, people talk about the vibe shifts. It's very different when Elon Musk comes into Twitter and turns it into X and just sacks a whole bunch of people, and the demographics in Twitter just change kind of overnight. A whole bunch of, you know, nerdy guys up all night kind of making this thing work, and then Elon Musk saying, you know, let's go to Mars. And that's a very different spirit to, is everybody okay?
Right, right.
You know, you never get to Mars if people are saying, are we all okay? How are we feeling about that?
How are you feeling about this?
Like, Elon doesn't care. Elon's going to Mars, right? And there's that sort of male-coded thing that I think is changing in the world and changing in the church. And I'm also finding that evangelistic topics that I'm asked to speak on are changing a bit. I think for the first 15 years of this century, maybe even for the first 20 years of this century, I would be invited onto a university campus to give talks on why Jesus is also a feminist, or why Jesus is also an environmentalist, or, you know, dot, 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 and very kind of soft left kind of sensibilities where it's okay, we're not the bogeyman that you thought we were. Jesus can sound like a feminist too, that kind of thing. Whereas now people are reading Louise Perry, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of saying, they're questioning everything. Because that old story has not worked, and it is becoming so obvious that it's not working. And so there are negative ways in which people are snapping back, and I'm not an apologist for Elon Musk and everything that he does, and I'm certainly not an apologist for everything that is male-coded. You know, Andrew Tate is not a positive role model, et cetera, et cetera. But I think in a culture which has looked towards some of those female-coded directions and seen that perhaps perhaps they are not as flourishing and life-giving, and perhaps the virtue signaling hasn't been virtuous. That mask has slipped.
Yeah.
And people are ready to figure out, is there such a thing as actual virtue?
Do you get the sense in America, it's interesting, kind of the rebirth, particularly with male Christianity, and Axiom actually just released something a couple of days ago that's showing, we hadn't seen data, but that there actually is something similar taking place in America right now. But ours is very, I think it's wrapped up politically. It's a politicized movement. I think part of the resurgence of conservative politics and the Republican Party and the Donald Trump phenomenon and all that is that it is unashamedly wrapped up in Christian rhetoric, and this kind of seized upon that. Is it being politicized over there? Is Christianity? That's a weird American thing, I guess. You're not doing that. Yeah. Okay.
Very, very much so. I mean, it's a Labour government over here, so we've just switched from, you know, conservative rule that wasn't very small C conservative at all, but nominally conservative, switching to Labour. But I have no idea who anybody votes for in my church. I have no idea who they voted for in the Brexit referendum. Nobody cares. We're just so small. We're not a voting bloc. And so we can't be leveraged for political purposes. And so it's just not that much of an issue.
Yeah. That's a concern I have. You all clearly don't have to worry about is this becoming a very, very quick, whatever revival is taking place is a very quickly being co-opted for political purposes, but which I do think is happening. But are there any concerns in your context then? I would like to ask, is there, we celebrate what God is doing, but I'm a little nervous or got some hesitation questions here. Anything like that going on?
Shall I go first and then Andy? I think, let me give you my little pep talk that I gave to Josh, this guy who sort of showed up to church 6 months ago. And it's a pep talk I give to every Peterson fan who shows up in church, because there is the danger of instrumentalizing Christianity and it's just another self-help project. So what I do with them is talk them through the parable of the prodigal son. And I say, do you know this story? And so often they don't. And I just say, well, you've got chaos and order, don't you? And this is Petersonian language, isn't it? You know, the world is divided, but it's a struggle between chaos and order. And for Peterson, you've got to balance the two. But here's a story of, here is the younger son taking the inheritance, and he goes off into the far country and maximizes hedonic pleasure and falls down into a pit of chaos, right? This is already a very Petersonian kind of story. And he needs more order in his life. That would be the Petersonian diagnosis. But that kind of is the younger son's diagnosis to begin with, because he says, I'll go back to my father and I'll say, I've sinned before heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. And so he goes back home with this sorry spiel, and he gives the sorry spiel to the father. And I make them recognize, what does the father not allow the younger son to say? He is not allowed to say, make me like one of your hired men. He cuts him off as soon as the younger son says, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. He then says, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put sandals on his feet. And the father will not let his younger brother become a slave. He will not become the younger brother. He will not let the younger brother become the older brother.
Right.
And what he does instead is he reconciles this wretch who is still stinking of pig, and he still robes him and he still celebrates him. My son was dead and he's alive again. And what we don't want is the younger brother to just become an older brother and become have more order in his life and 12 more rules for life. But I often say, you know, the next day I can quite imagine the prodigal son waking up in his old bedroom, and he pads down to the kitchen and there's his dad, and his dad is cooking eggs in the morning. And he says to his dad, once again, Dad, I'm so sorry about, and the father says, don't worry, it's done, it's forgotten. And then the father says to the son, what do you want to do today? And the son says, I don't know, Dad, what do you want to do today? And I reckon that day, the younger son might have worked in his father's homestead harder than the older brother ever had on the basis of grace. And it's kind of the third use of the law at that point, because you can then say, well, look, those 12 rules for life work really well once you are reconciled as a son before a father, still stinking of pig, but robed in righteousness. And now all that Petersonian stuff, the Bible can still land in the way that Peterson can make the Bible land for you. But you've got to put the law in its right place, and you've got to come home as a son, not as a slave. And that's the little pep talk that I always have to do to sort of, I was going to say detox the Petersonian converts. Not exactly detox, but redeem.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah. Mm. That's beautiful. Andy, concerns, words at this moment?
So I think, you know, on the real positive is so many guys, so many girls there. It's a quiet revival, because so much of it begins in their home, this search for meaning, this longing, and so the order of a Bible or checking things out online. I think the concern with that is that if you're being discipled digitally, that's the huge challenge. And I think in this whole father, this or crisis of masculinity, they find father figures in Jordan Peterson. They find father figures in whoever's the loudest voice, Joe Rogan, Andrew Tate, and the challenge is that some of them do come into our community, but they come and they're not ready. It's like they've got questions, but what they really, really need is embodied community. They need a father figure in the church. They need to hear the gospel, that the father speak to them, the words that we just heard there so pointedly in the prodigal son story. And sometimes I think that's the challenge. So many of the challenges I see is that 1 week you think you're getting somewhere, you meet someone with a coffee who's been reading the Bible, but the next week you meet with them and they've got so many questions from the latest podcast that they've listened to, or the latest discussion they've listened to online, and their whole life is very messy. There's syncretism of all things, and you're like, oh. So the word of caution is that there are people reading the Bible, there are people coming to church, and in that there have been numerous people who are getting saved and who are walking with the Lord. But there are others who are very confused. And I think it's an opportunity, and Glenn and you are doing this really well, is that you're inhabiting the online porch, as it were. You know, Keller spoke about we need to be in the, we need these porches, and we need a digital porch as well, where they're going to hear the gospel and the Christian vision. But the problem is that their algorithms often lead them to be discipled in all these very unhelpful ways. I think one of the cautions, the challenges I see at least, is just the influence of digital.
So what you're saying is, if somebody's listening to this and finding themselves strangely warm, get off the phone and go to church on Sunday quickly. If they listen to Glenn's amazing production, and I highly recommend Glenn's content. Mm. I think it's some of the best stuff out there right now of people who are engaging culture. But I think he'd be the first to say, I certainly would be the first to say, with the small amount of space that I hold online, that in-fleshed, embodied, in-person community church is the way forward.
Absolutely it is. But I think the online space is the third space that people have anymore. So in the same way, I mean, we do door knock the parish 3 times a year and make sure we're inviting people to church and that sort of thing. But it is easier to actually encounter more of our parish by doing a Facebook advertising campaign for our latest evangelistic course called 321. So it's both, you know.
Yeah.
It's both. But that embodied kind of discipleship is where evangelism is happening. You know, all these guys are coming into our church. And so going for long walks along the South Downs, which is this lovely kind of natural sort of parkland near where I live on the South Coast, just going for long walks and ending up in a pub and chatting with these guys is where evangelism is happening. It's where discipleship is happening, and it's all happening together, which is why I say it's a glorious mess. But I think maybe it was artificial for us to so remove evangelism from pastoral care.
Yeah.
that actually the messiness of it is making us see that evangelism is just pastoring non-Christians and pastoral care is just evangelizing Christians, and it happening together is perhaps a blessing.
Amen. All right. I need to let you all go. I want to respect your time. Real quickly, I'll link all of your ministries and socials and all stuff in there. But anyway, Americans, I mean, I joked with y'all beforehand, Americans love to get a hold of a exciting movement and try to come in and fix it. But, you know, to Americans listening outside of prayers, any way that they could be supportive of this moment, I don't know. I just know I'm going to get the question, hey, love those guys you had on, you know, da-da-da-da-da. Anything besides pointing them towards your all's work that you'd like to share?
I'll give a couple. And I've never met Glenn before this, so I don't know Glenn. But I will say, if people want to support a ministry that's digital, Glenn Speak Life 321, the evangelistic course, is an incredible course. If you want to give to Glenn Scrivener. I was on a tube just after in January. I looked across the guy and he was reading The Air We Breathe. I asked him why he was reading it. He said a colleague in his law firm told him to read it. And God is using the little efforts, the efforts that Glenn has put, the things he's put into print, the digital space. I would say support hugely the ministry of Glenn. And another one is the amount of people who are raving in my little network who are at From Praise at Glenn's talk spoken word poetry at this huge event that happened in the Royal Albert Concert Hall. So I want to just encourage, I think another one is, as you pray, if you've got friends, brothers and sisters in Christ in the UK, just send them a note of encouragement. We were encouragement starved. Things are small here. Resources are small. Sometimes the challenges seem huge, but just connect with your brothers and sisters in Christ in the UK and just encourage. And Robert, I have been on the receiving end of all your generosity of time, love, everything. And I think just keep on being generous as you Americans are in every way. Your concern for the global church is displayed in this podcast. But I just want to say, keep on doing what you're doing, because we're so deeply appreciative of it.
All right. Well, Glenn, if it's okay with you, I'll let Andy
Yeah, that was unexpectedly very, very encouraging. Thank you, Andy. Can I just say, if people are listening in from the UK, Justin Briley and I, Justin, who I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we're putting on a conference in London on the 22nd of November called Responding to the Rebirth, and we're going to spend a day at All Souls Langham Place thinking about all this stuff. How do we actually respond to these opportunities?
That's so great. What are those dates?
22nd of November, a day conference, so it's a Saturday. Central London, All Souls Langham Place. Stay tuned. We haven't yet released tickets, but you can save the date.
I bet some Americans would love. That's Thanksgiving break. Some Americans love to go celebrate Thanksgiving.
Oh, we would love them.
That'd be really fun. That'd be really fun. You're basically to unpack a lot of what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Try and think about, how do we respond? So it's, the strap line is just church be ready.
Oh, cool. Okay, guys, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for your valuable time. We'll stay in touch, but I'm very grateful for your work over there. I love Kentucky. That's my heart. That's my passion. But the UK is kind of my second home away from home. I love what the Lord's doing over there, and it's fun to be a part of. So grateful for you all.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
All right, take care.